You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
You know, this is a momentous day. Your hero, your North Star, Alex P. Keaton, Michael J. Fox, 60 years old today.
Are you serious, Bill?
Did I just break your soul? I know you're upset with the Trevor Wilburys.
Every time one of these things happen, whether it's Wilford Brimley or the Traveling Wilburys or whatever, I think there are always the ones that shock you. There are always extenuating circumstances, and I will posit one for Alex P. Keaton. He obviously was older than, or Michael J. Fox was obviously much older than the characters he was playing.
Correct.
That's why it feels so weird.
Right.
Like he must have been playing a character that would be 50 today.
Yeah.
Instead of 60 today. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. I mean, I think he was in his 20s when he was doing Family Ties.
He's playing like a 17-year-old probably when it started.
Yeah, I think he was in the later stages of high school, the character, when the show began.
Could be 16 even.
Yeah.
So I think that the whole point of this exercise from my standpoint, the rationalization that I'm going through, is that we are not old. He may be old because he was a fraud portraying a young person. We are still young and very hip. And by the way, let me just say, having kids is, I've gotten now to the point where, like, the hero worship is starting to fade of dad, and the dad is out of touch is starting to materialize. And my kids are starting to know technology better than me. Mm-hmm. And instead of, like, dad knows the cool, like, classic rock songs. There's something called 8D. I don't know if you've heard of this. And there's something, yeah, I don't even know. And then there's my kid is like into anime or something, mm-hmm. which I don't know if that's normal or if I'm gonna have a problem on my hands.
Yeah, anime, but anime, anime's fine. I mean, obviously, there's age appropriate anime and there's not age appropriate anime. But
well, I take solace in that. I dropped them off at a camp yesterday. Like, not a concentration camp or a work camp, but like, you know, like a summer camp. I dropped him off at a camp yesterday, and this one of the counselors, who was like a 14, 15-year-old girl, came running up and was like, I just want to say I love your shirt. He was wearing some sort of an anime T-shirt. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, maybe there's a method to this kid's madness after all. I'm not sure. But anyway, the whole point of this is that you and I still gaining acceptance in the polls, not ready to die.
You know, I was struck yesterday. I was flipping around the car radio. There's a country song that came out last year that I hadn't heard before called Breaking Up Was Easy in the 90s.
Oh, wow.
Like we're because of
Twitter and social media?
Yeah, exactly. But we're that far removed from this decade. This is literally 30 years ago. That people can talk about like some bygone era where things were wildly different.
Well, it is, though. It is. I mean, if you think of, okay, like you and I, when we were growing up, if you mentioned like, oh, the Kennedy election, you'd be like, it was like 100 years ago, it was like a black and white. It was like, you know, but like really, that was not that long ago at the time, right? When we were kids in the 80s, let's say. Mm-hmm. It was like the 90s are now.
I just feel
Nirvana is like if you said, like, you know, check out this band Nirvana, that would be like check out, you know, Herman's Hermits or whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
but in my mind, I feel the 80s is more culturally distinct a time than the 90s. I mean, obviously the 90s were different in that it was, you know, pre 9/11. Mostly pre-internet, pre-social media. Like I cerebrally understand why that's different than today. But I guess I feel more of a difference pre-Cold War, post-Cold War. pre-Reagan era Wall Street greed and more, I feel the 90s began more of a culturally progressive era. Whereas I lived in the 80s, where did not feel culturally progressive at all. So it's weird that people draw the lines in different places where things tip.
I feel like my sweet spot's 87 to 98, 99. If I could go back in time and just hang out for a week, you know what I mean? Maybe meet up with Doc Brown, you know. I feel like any time between 87 and 99, I fit right in. I slide right into that. And things would be awesome. Things were pretty awesome back then. Now, look, there's every era has something, some bad stuff in it. There's no, you know, there's no perfect time. But it was pretty close. It was pretty awesome back then, you know?
Let me shift gears. So I had a tweet last night. Total throwaway tweet.
Hardly, those are the ones that'll get you.
Hardly anything that I think is all that brilliantly insightful. But it was while Kamala was doing her press conference. And this is the day after she had the interview with Lester Holt, and she got tangled up in trying to answer why she hadn't been to the border yet. And I hadn't even reading Twitter so much, but I figured, you know, here's Kamala doing this fairly defensive dissertation why she's trying to get here in Mexico City and Guatemala and finding root causes, you know, and, you know, the border's not the biggest thing in the universe. And so I assume there are people already criticizing it. And so I said, mock every Kamala misstep if you want. But in 48 years, she'll have immensely more experience navigating the most politically tricky.
4 to 8 years. You said 4 to 8 years.
Yeah.
Okay. It sounded like you said 48 years.
No. 4 to 8 years. She will have immensely more experience navigating the most politically tricky issues than anybody else who might run for president. And, I mean, that doesn't automatically mean she's going to be president. That's just a matter-of-fact observation. And so this tweet, most of my tweets, you know, get like a few likes here and there. You know, I spent the last 2 days tweeting about filibuster history and going 10 rounds with all sorts of people. And like those tweets, you know, will get like, you know, a dozen likes and replies and stuff like that. This tweet has 5,104 likes. 461 retweets, 362 quote tweets, and hold on 1 second here. I'm trying to get to the reply count. I think it's several hundred replies. So it's not officially ratioed, mind you.
No. I think that ratioed would be if there are more replies than likes, it's not, and tweet and retweet.
It's not more replies than likes, but it is still an inordinate amount of replies, considering the weight of the tweet itself. And so it has a lot of retweets,
yeah,
and likes. Because K-Hive jumped on it and wanted to share it. I got a little bit of, like, what missteps? You know, there aren't even any missteps. What are you talking about? But by and large, people saw it as a favorable tweet for Kamala.
Yeah.
But then you get...
All right, well... No, I'm sorry. Keep going.
But then you have this faction of people on the right who are... blitzing the tweet saying Kamala is an idiot who slept her way to the top and her idiocy is being exposed to the world. 834 replies. 834.
Okay.
And I got a bunch of stuff from the far left saying, by misstep, you mean that she's a racist who doesn't want people to immigrate from here and take advantage of our asylum laws. It is just this level of intensity that I haven't experienced in a while because I haven't been tweeting about Kamala all that much. And it just makes my wheels turn. Like, what is it about Kamala that triggers this really outsized response for, like, you know, basic punditry? like not all that.
Yeah.
It's all punditry.
All right, well, I have, there's a, this is, you know, multiple levels of conversation that I want to get into, but let's just start with the initial question, which is, why has this evoked such controversy? I think two things. One is that because Biden is boring, because it's like really impossible to demonize. You know, McKay Coppins had this piece in The Atlantic last week about how, remember all the books that people, you know, outlets like Regnery used to churn out about, you know, Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama and, you know, why Barack Obama hates America, hell to pay, that kind of thing. So, like, those books are impossible to sell on Joe Biden. It's impossible to, like, criticize Joe Biden. And so I think Kamala Harris is serving that role as the lightning rod. That's point number one. What say you to that before I continue down this path?
I think that's true. The question is, what is it about Kamala that makes that the case? Is it race? Is it gender? Is it that she is seen as president in waiting? Combination of all things. This normally vice presidents don't attract this much obsession, attention, outrage. So not this early. We're 6 months into the presidency, and people are freaking out. I would agree that, like, she didn't handle Lester Holt's question great, but, like, in the annals of gaffes, this is hardly like a history making gaffe. But people are treating it like it's all over for Kamala.
Well, the other thing is, before I get to the merits of the gaffe, which I do want to get to. But the other thing is, as you noted, Bill, she's getting it from the left and the right.
Yeah.
We understand why the right doesn't like her. But the left, it sounds to me like there's a pretty good number of people who are upset at her for basically saying, don't come to the border.
Biden has already said. You know, Biden said the same thing. She's not freelancing. Yeah. Why is she getting 100 times more criticism for it than Biden did?
From the left, you mean?
Yes.
Okay. So, well, could it be that because she's a woman or because she's a woman of color from the left? Probably not. It's probably because they have decided that their ability to work the refs as it pertains to Biden is more limited. That she actually, because she's younger and has a future that she's worried about, that she may be more susceptible to some brushback. What do you think?
I don't think you can separate race and gender here. I mean, you might say, you know, the left isn't, these people, these far left people aren't racist and sexist. I mean, maybe some would say that, but, and this is just pure speculation. I mean, it's hard to get in people's minds. It's hard to, people aren't going to say these kinds of thoughts out loud or even be cognizant of them. But I think there is a sense of betrayal that Kamala would say something like that, that Biden doesn't. So Biden gets held to a different standard. You expect Biden to be a latently racist, sexist, old white guy.
Kamala, or at least out of touch.
Right. Kamala is a product of Berkeley. Kamala is a product of civil rights activist. How dare she make that kind of argument?
I think that's an astute observation, Bill. I think it makes a lot of sense. And is that a bad or a wrong conclusion to come to if you're on the left? It seems to me that that's actually a pretty logical expectation to have.
Well, I mean, I think people should be judging their positions by the positions. I mean, I'm not the biggest anti-identity politics person in the universe, but, you know, age, background, race, gender should have no bearing on your assessment of the position. If you don't like that the Biden administration's position is to say to potential asylum seekers in Central and South America, don't come here, then oppose that position. But you shouldn't give Kamala a harder time about it than the person who decides that position, which is the President of the United States. Of course, Kamala Harris is going to salute and echo the position of her, of the top of the ticket, of the person who controls the administration, because that is her function as vice president.
I understand that, but I also understand, you know, you're making a logical, rational argument, but I understand the frustration. I'll put myself in their shoes a little bit. So I am more mad and frustrated and disappointed by people like Marco Rubio than I am at Donald Trump. Donald Trump is who I thought he was. Donald Trump doesn't surprise me that much. Marco Rubio has really disappointed me and frustrated me more. And I could imagine, now this isn't perfectly analogous, of course, but I could imagine a scenario where, you know, Kamala Harris runs for president, stakes out this, I think, unwise, maybe even inauthentic progressive, you know, platform, then becomes Biden's Veep. But, you know, I think there's also an expectation that she's going to be Veep plus, you know, because Biden, there was a time at least when he was thought to be like a transition president and that she was the heir apparent. And, you know, just because you salute the president doesn't mean you have to be complicit in everything. I mean, like when Mike Pence could be a loyal vice president, maybe he didn't need to go like to the border and put on that bomber jacket and the sunglasses, or maybe I'm confusing that with what he did in North Korea, but whatever the case may be, like you don't always have to be a good soldier necessarily, right?
Well, I don't quite agree with that. I mean, I think that anything a vice president does, a vice president who is a very likely successor nominee, there are people who even think that Kamala is so conniving, she's trying to find a way to become president before Biden is done with the term, you know. Anything she did to have any daylight with Joe Biden would attract such a crush of attention, of critique, of analysis. It would be extraordinarily distracting if she ever did anything like that. So, I think as a general matter, VPs don't want to create daylight with their presidents, and 100 times more so with Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
And
well, she doesn't have to publicly break with him, but she also doesn't have to go out and say, like, do not come to the border, stay where you are, you know.
She's tasked by the president to be the person, the point person on border policy. She has to comment on border policy and be in line with what the president's policy is.
Apparently she doesn't have to go to the border, so why does she have to say what he wants her to say?
But go ahead. I mean, I think the same reason why Kamala attracted such outsized criticism in the VP selection process is the presumption she is being queued up to succeed Joe Biden, whether it is in 4 or 8 years. Yeah. And there are still, and I think the reaction to Kamala getting the nomination was by and large positive in the Democratic Party. I think most Democrats are perfectly good with Biden being followed by Kamala. Let me put one wrinkle on that. So yeah, one,
AOC attacked Kamala on Twitter. Well, did you see that?
Well, there is a faction of people on the hard left who never liked Kamala getting in the first place for this exact reason, because they don't think they never thought she was progressive enough. There always was the Kamala as a cop, you know, crowd, and they want to undercut her, so she is less and less seen as the president in waiting, not seen as the inevitable nominee. And so if they can get that, if they can roll back the inevitability aura beyond their own crowd, if you can get people who are less progressive to also say, you know, she's really kind of blowing it here. I mean, she really did not handle that well. I'm not so sure she can pick up the swing states the way Joe Biden can. That's opening up the whenever the next primary is going to be.
Right. All right. I would just say, first of all, I honestly believe that this is more a product of Biden of Biden being so much Teflon that there is a market demand for controversy for someone to be mad at and to be excited about. And Biden isn't filling that role. I think he should be happy he's not. So I think this is more about Biden than Harris. But I agree, part of it is all the things we've talked about here. Now, here's one, and I've got a whole bunch of thoughts about this, but I want to challenge your tweet additionally from a different angle.
Okay.
You are making the argument that by enduring this experience, Kamala Harris will become a better politician, a more prepared politician who learns from the experience. I would contend, I'm not sure. I feel like if you look at politicians, sort of, you know, great politicians, which is to say, they don't necessarily get better over time. They have a window of time, which is their prime, you know? Like Bruce Springsteen can continue to put out albums, but really from 1975 to 1985, that's a long run, but that's sort of his window, right? And like, I mean, look at Hillary Clinton's a prime example. Shouldn't she have been a better candidate in 2016 than she was in 2008? I mean, think of all the experience she accrued, right? She was the first lady. Then she was a senator from New York. You know, then she was the Secretary of State. Then she ran for president with, you know, the whole gauntlet of running as Obama. Actually, she did that. Then she became Secretary of State. Well, you know, I'm getting it out of order. But the point is, I would argue that Hillary actually regressed, that she did not continue to get better based on the experience that she had dealing with scandals and controversies, that actually sometimes what happens is the world chips you down and you get worse. And you are making I think you're assuming that this experience is going to make Kamala a better politician. And I just don't know that there's evidence of that.
Well, the tweet itself doesn't say she will get better. It says she will have more experience navigating politically tricky issues. I just think that's just a matter of plain fact. She,
okay, but aren't you implying that this will help her?
Well, it certainly gives her the opportunity to grow and improve. Now, it may be that she doesn't have the capacity for growth. Not, you know, I mean, I think Hillary Clinton was a better politician in 2016 than 2008, but there still were.
I don't.
Well, one second.
I don't.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Shoot. Can we pause, Matt? Oh, no.
Sure.
That's right. What's going on here? Can you talk for a sec, Matt?
Yeah, check. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Testing. 1, 2, 3.
Oh, okay. All right. We're fine. We're fine. We're fine. I'm sorry. Let me just start over. You know, she still had some notable mistakes, like the coal answer in West Virginia. You know, she didn't shake off every weakness in her persona. But I don't think she was like a blubbering mess. She had to do she had to walk a pretty complicated high wire act the whole way through and dealing with an unexpected socialist insurgency and then a right-wing populist insurgency. You know, she was buffeted by a lot of things that would test a lot of politicians. So, you know, you can grow and still not be good enough. But I just think that people should recognize, I mean, and this goes with a point that I've made a lot of times. VPs have a leg up in primaries. Now, it doesn't mean they win generals all the time, but VPs have, there's a stature gap, there's an experience gap, there's a name ID gap, there's a familiarity gap, there's a donor network gap, there's advantages, built-in advantages that VPs have, and Kamala's going to get that. Now, it may come with, you know, these other complicating factors because she is the first African-American, Asian-American woman VP who has an already semi-antagonistic relationship with people on the hard activist left. But those other advantages are still there, and this is one of them. There are 20 ways she could have answered Lester Holt's question better. But other candidates are going to have to suffer tough questions when that primary occurs, and they're going to have their gas too, most likely. I mean, there are things that Buttigieg and Harris and Booker and Gillibrand had to go through that was not new to Biden. And I think that stuff makes a difference.
So I think here's a place where I'll sort of agree with you. So what Kamala Harris did reminded me of Sarah Palin. It was that bad. And I think it's unfair that Palin was, Kamala Harris's performance was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And even if you take away, we could talk about the substantive part of it, but just from an optics standpoint, someone who is in politics at the level Kamala Harris is at, who, I mean, she just comes across so bad. She seems phony. She seems defensive. She seems to be like obfuscating. It's not a good look. And of course, Palin got really crucified for, I think, somewhat similar missteps. But the difference is that, you know, well, there's the media that I think is giving Kamala Harris more or less a pass, probably. But the other difference is, this goes to your point, like, if Harris can learn from this and grow, like, Palin didn't have that chance. Palin was airdropped in the middle of a presidential race and basically thrown in the deep end and told to swim without the experience. And so, you know, if she takes advantage of it and improves. But I guess the one problem I would have with Kamala Harris is I'm actually not sure that she can get better. Like, I kind of feel like this was revealing something about her, that it was more revelatory. It's not a product of her being inexperienced or green. It's a product of there is like this product that is Kamala Harris. And sometimes, man, it works great. It runs great. But there is like this faulty like problem with this product that just like every once in a while it spins out of control. And I just like, I think this may be, you know, I don't know what the analogy is, like a quarterback who like has flashes of brilliance, but every, you know, throws an interception at the end of the game. I don't know what the analogy is, but like, I think that like Kamala Harris just may not be that good at the end of the day.
Look, you know, George H.W. Bush ended 8 years of being Reagan's VP with the reputation of being a wimp. It literally was like a famous cover of Newsweek magazine, The Wimp Factor.
I remember. He's in like a boat, right? He's in a boat wearing like a yellow raincoat, I think. Something like that.
And, you know, he didn't clear the field in 1988. He had to deal with Bob Dole and a host of other characters. But he gutted it out. And Joe Biden, gaffe machine, out of touch, hangs out with surrogationists. You know, there's all sorts of bad reputation attributes that he supposedly had, and he, you know, gutted it out. So, you know, there's no way Kamala finishes 4 to 8 years as VP without some negative aspect of a narrative being part of the story. There's going to be critics, obviously. The question is: is it going to be so damning and to politically fail? Now, to your specific to what you're saying, like if I was her media trainer, and I've done media training, So I'm not completely talking out of my butt here. She has a diagnosable problem, which is,
oh, do tell.
When she's asked an uncomfortable question, she tends to respond with, she tends to give a glib response. And a glib response is often the wrong response.
All right.
That's
glib would be, so by glib you mean like just sort of,
well, you haven't gone to Europe.
Instead of,
I mean, that's right. That's the worst part of that response. You know, the proper response to that question, you know, why have you gone to the border? I've been to the border many times when I was senator of California. I know what the border looks like. I don't need to learn what a border looks like. We need to understand why people are coming here and why and what we can do so they don't want to come here in the first place. And that's why I went down to Mexico and Guatemala to talk to actual human beings and learn what their needs are. And so we can come up with policy solutions that are going to help them and help us.
That's a much better answer, Bill. That's a much better answer. Okay. Let me just unpack.
That's teachable. That's a teachable thing.
Well, okay. Seems like it should be. Sometimes I've found that trying to teach people makes them worse. Because especially if you're already overwhelmed, you know, like I just got done coaching baseball. And like, you know how some parents are. You know, yelling at the kid, do this, do that. Sometimes, like, I might say, like, I might think, well, he needs to choke up a little bit. And I will, like, not say anything. Because sometimes then it gets in their head. And I wonder, because, Bill, apparently she was going through, I don't know if you read, she apparently has been doing media training. And remember, Reagan supposedly was, like, overcoached during that first debate in 84.
Not all media trainers are good. And you can get this crush of advice. We got 10 people telling you 10 different things and overload your brain. You can't make sense of it. I'm telling you, as I just did, she has a distinct problem.
Can you think of another example where she's made this same mistake? Or it's just you just have the sense that you've seen this before.
I'd have to go back and look at. I think I do have seen this before. I mean, she was being pressed on the debate with Biden. I mean, I don't think this is quite as troubling for her, but mm-hmm. she kind of give like a laugh and kind of just sort of wave it off and not answer the question. I mean, I think. In that respect, it's a little hard to find the right answer there. So perhaps that's the best you can do. I mean, I think I could come up with something. In this case, in this particular case, like she had a, there is a reason why she went to the countries and not the border.
Yeah.
That answer should have been in her quiver. And she could have leaned.
She didn't have to resort.
That's right.
This should be a, I suspect that the reason she has developed this habit is that it works in some occasions, like especially if you're not interacting with Lester Holtz's all the time. I mean, I could see that her behavior would shut down a staffer trying to give her advice or someone who's not an equal. Maybe this is a habit that's developed by her ability to shut down people that are not on an equal playing field with her.
You can look at things that Bill Clinton did in the early 90s where you'd say, whoever thought this guy was a political maestro? He would get hammered for doing some of those things today. But different standards, different times. You know,
yeah.
The standards Kamala has been judged by are different than the standards she's going to be judged by now because she's VP and senior president in waiting. So little things that maybe she could do that could shut down people or move on things quickly aren't going to work as easily now.
All right. I need to make one more point before we move on, or we could just do the whole show on this, frankly. I find this interesting. But Kamala, you're keying in on her like, well, I haven't been to Europe either. Like, has she not been to Europe ever?
I think she might have VP.
I mean, I have to wonder. I don't know. Maybe she's never actually been to Europe or the border. I assume she's been to both, but who knows?
I know she said subsequently that she has been to the border as senator.
But here's what bothers me most about it. She said at least three times, maybe four, we've been to the border. We've been to the border. We've been to the border. And then finally, Lester says, we've been to the border. Have you been? You've been to the border? And then she's like, we've been, you know. So she was trying to pass off this bullshit, you know, royal we, I assume meaning somebody from the Biden administration has been to the border. And a lot of interviewers might have just let that go and not challenged it, you know, either just. You know, assuming, well, she meant I.
And what,
she
said we, and what, she and what meant doesn't I. What doesn't work with that is that she's been tasked as the point person on the issue. She is effectively she is in charge of this project. So she can't do royal we. I mean, she could have said, there's a reason why
but
I don't need to go, and this is
why.
The
fact that she was trying to, I think, speaks to a question of honesty. This is deeper. She's trying. I mean, this is like Bill Clinton's, it depends on what your definition of the word is. This is an attempt to manipulate language to mislead people.
I think that's overblown, man. I think she was trying to communicate a royal we, and so it doesn't matter if I personally go, the administration has gone, and so it's not so important. But that wasn't the right thing to say. The right thing to say.
I think she's trying to say, I've been to the border without lying. She can't say I've been to the border. She wants you to think she's been to the border. So she says, we've been to the border.
Yeah.
Right? That's what it feels like to me. And that means I can't trust her. So that speaks to honesty.
Okay. So I think if that's going to be your standard for the politicians you trust, the politicians you don't trust, you've hereby declared you will not trust any politician ever. Because that is...
Well, I don't trust most of them, that's for sure. But don't you think... I don't want to make too much of this. But it may be something that is telling about her character.
It's telling you that she's a politician, which is a given.
Okay, I mean, but don't you think that, like...
It was a politician-y response, and she should have given him something better than that.
I think it was really, really bad. And so I understand why this issue has become. And here's the other thing too, Bill. The fact that it's on videotape, the fact that she's being interviewed by Lester, it's just so bad. And that video can be shared on Twitter. It's a credible interviewer who's challenging her. It's not Newsmax or something.
It's not good, but it's not going to be running in a loop when she runs for president in 2028. It's not potato, you know. It's not the worst thing that a vice president has ever done.
Why is it? Why? That's a valid point. I think potato wasn't that big of a deal. Why did the media make potato that big of a deal? But this isn't. I think this is worse.
But I mean, the potato episode. It's Dan Quayle is the only vice president in the history of the modern primary era who ran for president and didn't get his party's nomination. He is the lone exception. And potato has a lot to do with that. You're talking about Palin. Quayle was dropped into the cauldron without a lot of prep. He had a bad day one when he was announced. He came across like an immature boy. And it was a terrible rollout. And so it already was a narrative that he was in over his head that got exacerbated in the debate with Lloyd Benson. And the only way to overcome that is to not seem like an idiot. And he kept doing things to make him seem like an idiot. So the potato thing wasn't in a vacuum. It was after some key events where people already presumed he was an idiot. And that just like, you have just confirmed it for all time. You can't even spell third grade words. I am done with you.
Bill, I feel like the media that young up and coming conservatives like Dan Quayle perceived as a threat. They took him down. Yeah, of course there was. Of course, misspelling potato played into a narrative that they created, you know, and they perpetuated this narrative about him. And like, okay, if I own Saturday Night Live and I could create a narrative about Kamala Harris, then we could say that her not going to the border and lying about it or misleading people about it also played into a narrative. I mean, what Kamala Harris did, how to describe this? Like, I'll put it this way. What Donald Trump did in Ukraine, never mind the insurrection, what Donald Trump did in Ukraine was worse than Watergate, in my opinion. And yet, Watergate, for whatever reason, took down a president. And I feel like I spent half my life hearing about Watergate and everything's called Gate. Okay. But for some reason, some people skate, some people slide, and other people are taken down by something. Dan Quayle misspelling, and actually, maybe it's an acceptable spelling of potato somewhere. I don't know, it's a silly.
Let's establish just the fact that it's not.
How's tomato spelled? Is there any on that? I think so. I don't know. Whatever the case may be. It's a silly, stupid little gaffe that the media made into a huge story. I think what Kamala Harris did was worse, but you're right. It won't ultimately. I think it matters in the sense that it suggests more to come. Kamala just does not have it, I suspect. But in terms of this being played on a loop, I think you're right. I just think it's messed up that, you know, again, Palin, Dan Quayle, and then I'll get you out of here on this. I'll shut up on this. This is one of the reasons that conservatives went with Donald Trump, because of the way that people like Quayle and Palin were taken down by the media. And I think Palin was partly radicalized by the media. I think that helped turn her into the monster she became. I think that they tuned out the media because of that, and they went for a strong man who wouldn't be Watergated like Donald Trump. Okay.
So we that was a good 30 minutes of Kamala, I think. So proving the point of the tweet, people just can't stop talking about Kamala. I can
see. I think you were trolling us. I think you did that just for the clicks, Bill, just for the tweet.
I can talk about a few different things I know. So I've written about filibuster history this week. I've written about what to do about election subversion. And I guess sort of tangential to filibuster history, we could talk about the infrastructure deal, where that stands.
And we need to do it all in 15 minutes. I think all of that is connected, and all of it is relevant.
Well, why don't I start with the
and you've been killing it with the columns.
Well, read what I wrote in Real Clear Politics on filibuster history, because I think it's important. Yeah. I don't think anyone's done it, connected those dots, because
you pointed out what two or three other prominent voices who've written about the filibuster and tried to paint a narrative of what they got wrong.
Well, Sinema made a comment last week that the filibuster was created to foster bipartisanship, which Jonathan Chait and others point out that's wrong. That's not why it was created. And, Chait called it fake history, that propaganda by filibuster proponents. And like, I've defended the filibuster. I'll tell you right out, that's not true history. That's not what happened. But there's also this filibuster history that the filibuster critics have put forth for a long time. And it's also deeply flawed. Not necessarily disingenuously so. I mean, I think people just made certain mistakes. But it has sort of got things out of whack. And the two narratives are actually dissonant. So there is the filibuster is an accent of history narrative, which starts with Aaron Burr when he was VP in 1805, told the Senate, you got to clean up your rule book. It's a mess. You got this thing called the previous question motion. It's redundant. You don't need that. Why don't you get rid of that thing? And it wasn't used as a debate closer at the time, but the House then later used it to cut off debate, and the Senate didn't have it. Some people have got the bright idea to have starting filibusters. 3 decades later, they could. That's one argument. And then there is the filibuster is not an accident. It's that the pro-slavery Southerners and the segregationists made it, honed it. It's why we have it. It's a Jim Crow relic. And it is those reactionary racist forces that benefit the most from it. And that's why we have to get rid of it. And Adam Gentleson is a big pusher of this narrative. And in his book, Kill Switch, he says that every measure that was killed between Reconstruction and 1964 were civil rights measures. And so there are two things. There's a key thing wrong with each of those prongs of the narrative. One is that the initial filibusters were not started in 1837 as an outgrowth of Aaron Burr's rule change. They were from ancient Rome. And Cato the Younger had this filibuster tear. They called it diem consumiere, which is to consume the day. And those in the Roman Senate, like the meeting ended at nightfall. So you can talk through nightfall, meeting's done. They had private tax collection, and the private tax collectors wanted to jack up the rates, and Cato said that's bullshit. And so he talked and talked and talked until that measure that was for 6 months. For 6 months, he filibustered that attempt until the tax collectors gave up. And the big one was with Caesar. Caesar wanted, he had a military campaign in Spain. He wanted a parade. It actually was a rule that if you were going to run for office, you couldn't get a parade. And he was about to run for office. He wanted an exception. And Cato was already nervous.
Sound like somebody we know, Bill.
Yeah, exactly. And Cato didn't want Caesar getting that parade as a kickoff to his
Orange Julius.
Yeah. Didn't want him to get that parade. So he filibustered the parade successfully, but that just made Caesar, you know, double down, like bring stuff to the People's Assembly, and Cato ended up being on the outs, and Caesar took over power. Cato then killed himself, not did rather live under Caesar's rule. The founders revered Cato. It's not like this is some random thing that nobody knew about. They literally had a play about Cato at Valley Forge, when they were dying at Valley Forge, they put a play about Cato. And there's a line in that play that Patrick Henry modified when he said, give me liberty or give me death. Like, that's how much the founders like Cato. So they knew the history. And if they wanted to ban, and you know, there are people today that argue that Cato's filibustering contributed to the fall of Rome, that the obstructionist tactics were too much. If the founders felt that way, they could have banned it. Now, people accurately point out, well, it's not in the Constitution. There's no filibuster rule in the initial rules of the Senate. The founders didn't actively put this in there. That's all true, but they didn't actively stop it either. And so when people say the first filibuster was 1837, actually, there is contemporaneous evidence of a filibuster in 1790. An attempt to block the Capitol being established in Philadelphia by the Senators of the South tried to stop that. So if somebody will actually point out, there's a line in Jefferson's manual, which actually informally guided the Senate, saying people shouldn't talk about non-germane things. If once that happened, people said, hey, that you're violating Jefferson's manual. We need a stronger rule to stamp this out. They could have done it, and they didn't. It's been around from the beginning. There's a political scientist, Gregory Koger, that points out, at any point in time, a majority of senators could have changed the rules, just like they did to nuke the filibuster for judges. If you could do it then, you could do it before. If they wanted to muster that strength to make sure there were no filibusters ever, they could do it at any time. They did it because they didn't want to. And today, maybe not by many numbers, but there are not enough senators to change the filibuster because people want it. So Chaitin's his column saying no one will create the system on purpose. Well, we have a silent filibuster because Mike Mansfield in 1970 created this system to end the talking filibusters and create silent filibusters. It was on purpose. And people might not like the byproduct of it, but if you want to change it, you need the if you have the numbers, you can change it. So it's what I'm saying here doesn't compel you to like the filibuster. You can still hate it and want it changed as being anti-majoritarian. But there's a reason why, just like there's a reason why cinema has a fanciful history to defend it, the critics have a fanciful history to criticize it because they think it helps the argument. And it doesn't allow you to have the debate over the actual nature of the filibuster itself.
Yeah, look, and I mean, we're hearing about it being white supremacist, right supremacist, and a relic. I mean, Barack Obama called it a Jim Crow relic, yeah, even though he's used it himself. And so, yeah, I just think it's disingenuous and it's bad history. And, you know, again, you can dislike it on the merits, and but don't lie or misrepresent it. Let me just say also, I interviewed Thomas Ricks a couple months ago. He has a book out called First Principles.
Yeah.
And it's about how the founders looked to the Greeks and the Romans. And the part where you talked about give me liberty, forgive me death, and about Cato and things like that, it's in his book. And I would recommend it, and check out my podcast conversation with him.
Now, this is all relevant, of course, because the filibuster is still here, and it impacts whether we get a voting rights bill, it impacts whether we get an infrastructure deal. You know, people are still focused on how do I get Manchin to break, in the case of infrastructure, to go to reconciliation, in the case of voting rights, to abolish filibuster. So we have this infrastructure deal, you know, Biden Capito hit a brick wall, but we're not rushing to reconciliation. Biden said, I'm not going to talk to this group of 20 bipartisan senators, which Manchin's a part of. And some progressives are tearing their hair out. Like, can't you see what's happening here? They're trying to, run down the clock. And the fact of the matter is, until Joe Manchin says, forget it, forget the Republicans, they're a waste of time here, you can't go to reconciliation. I mean, and with voting rights, I think, Manchin is playing the same card, and progressives say, look, there's just no chance here. There's just no way they're going to do this. This is just an exercise in total futility. And in the case of voting rights, Manchin can't as easily force the passage of a successful bill. But with infrastructure, I mean, Manchin today has the power to say, look, this Capito deal is a good deal. I'm not going to vote for anything above and beyond this deal. So you can take it or you get nothing. Like, I'm not saying he's going to do that. I'm saying he has the power to do that. There is an actual Republican deal on the table that he can hold up and use that to say this has to be done. And if whatever comes out of this group of 20, if they come with something a little bit bigger, Manchin could say, I'm not going to go higher than this. And maybe it doesn't get 10 Republicans, but it'll get 5 Republicans. And I'm telling you, I'll do this in reconciliation, but no more. Why would Manchin do that? Because this is an assumption. I can't read Manchin's mind. If Manchin, everyone's like, Manchin, you're looking like an idiot. You're talking about bipartisanship and you're being mocked by McConnell. He's making like a fool. Can't you understand that? Manchin could either say, you're right, I'm sick of these Republicans, I'm sorry I made a mistake, let's just go forth on our own. He could. But if he wants to be proven correct, if he wants everyone to think, I told you so, bipartisanship can work, don't call me an idiot, I proved it could work, he can make it work. He has the power with infrastructure. I mean, that's with voting rights. With infrastructure, he can say, you have to take this deal that has Republican support or you don't get my vote otherwise. So make up your mind now if you want or not. So it comes down to what we think Manchin wants at the end of the day. All I can argue is that if he wants to be proven right, he can be proven right. He has the ability to make that happen. Again, barring the left bolting and undercutting.
And you're saying with infrastructure, because that could be done via reconciliation as opposed to the voting. Well,
A, reconciliation, and B, he has a Republican offer on the table now. There, something exists that has Republican support. With voting rights, there's nothing. There's nothing to hold up. He has at least the capital offer. There'll probably be something that he gets from Romney.
Is there
College
a chance
Department.
They can do? Is there a chance they could do the voting bill through reconciliation if they had Manchin's vote?
Well, only insofar as you could spend money on existing election administration programs. I mean, which is part of HR1, but things that are policy, you can't say all states must have independent redistricting commissions. You can't do that through reconciliation. You can't say all states must have no excuse absentee mail voting. You can't do that.
Right. All right. Well, sadly, I have to bounce. But any final thoughts or things you want to plug?
I guess the only thing that it's not really it's an article that well, you should read my article on election subversion in the Washington Monthly, where I talk about what because there's very little policy wise in HR1 about election subversion. It's more about voter suppression type stuff. And so I got to talk to some election law pros about what could be done on that score. And I make the extra argument that if you actually want to pass that sort of thing and you think bipartisanship is a dead letter, what's the Hail Mary play that's out there? A Bush-Obama commission, a blue ribbon commission with George Bush and Barack Obama, which we did after 2000 with Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford that did actually produce bipartisan election reform legislation. So read that. And I'll just leave it at that as far as plugs are concerned.
Okay. Check out my stuff at The Beast and the podcast on iTunes, Matt Lewis and the News. And we'll see you back here next week.
All righty. Take care.